Thanks very much, and a very special welcome to everybody who's joining us for another installment of our MSD and Geek Speak series. As mentioned, my name is Glenn Gordon. I'm a developer evangelist with Microsoft, and my co-host on today's Geek Speak is Andrew Duffy. Andrew, how's it going?
It's going great, Glenn. Sunny day outside, not a hint of snow these days, which is a great change from last month, so I'm a happy camper right now. And we are lucky to have with us...
Down in Atlanta.
What's that?
I said it's a nice day down in Atlanta as well. So
you know, I heard earlier last week. I heard they actually had snow down in Texas though. So better not count our chickens before they're hatched, so to speak.
Definitely.
So
Andrew and I are both developer evangelists in Microsoft, and what we do is spend a lot of our time out in the community, and we run into tons of folks who are experts in a wide variety of technologies. And what we do is we bring them on this MSDN GeekSpeak webcast series and give people that are attending live an opportunity to ask their questions in real time. Andrew, I noticed this picture here. I think that's the impact of one of your forays out into the community. You want to tell us the story behind that real briefly?
Yeah, sure. So this weekend we had the first ever GiveCamp event on the East Coast. GiveCamps are a type of event that was actually created by one of our colleagues from the central region in Dallas, a guy named Chris Koenig, and he collaborated with some members of the community to put together an event where about generally around 100 or so developers get together and spend a weekend working for some pre-selected nonprofit organizations to help them kind of get their IT muscles built up a little bit. So in the case of the Southern Maryland Give Camp, which just took place this weekend, we had about 100 volunteers and developers and 18 nonprofit organizations. And so in the space of about 48 hours, each of those nonprofit organizations got, for the most part, most of them got working websites based on CMSs like .NET Nuke or Sitefinity that would basically give them a nice, polished web presence that they could then manage on an ongoing basis. So rather than having to kind of develop something from scratch and then figure out how to maintain it, they've got something that they're trained up on and can be more effective in their missions without having to have a whole lot of IT infrastructure and an expense associated with that. So the picture, of course, how the picture came to be is the guy who organized the GiveCamp, a guy named Jim Pendarvis, runs the .NET user group down in Southern Maryland, and he said that if they got 100 volunteers, he said he would shave his head. Well, Jim didn't have much hair to begin with, so my response was, well, Jim, that's not much of an incentive because he ain't got no hair. So here's what we're going to do. I said, if we got 100 volunteers, I'll get a mohawk. And I started passing that info around the community, and the community, for some reason, really wanted to see me humiliated, so they rallied around that and made sure that we had plenty of volunteers. And so we had a great success this weekend, and I was as good as my word and got my mohawk.
Yeah, there's some amazing community experiences we have when we're out and about. And I think the GiveCamp website, that's givecamp.org, if people are interested in organizing one in their own area, right?
Yep. And we've got a number of them in planning for the East Coast. I know I think the next one coming up is going to be in the Philly area, so anybody who's interested in that should reach out to our colleague Danny Diaz, or they can just contact either Glenn or me via our blogs, and we can put you in touch with the right folks.
Right. And our blogs are listed in this slide deck, and we'll bring that up towards the end, or you can just go to msdngeekspeak.com, and that'll take you to a page that has all the links to find your way around. So as mentioned, the GeekSpeak series is a little different from a traditional webcast because rather than have a set of slides we work through, we try to keep things conversational and have our guests share their knowledge and take questions real time. So Andy Leonard is our guest today, and he's from Andrew's part of the world. So Andrew, why don't you go ahead and introduce Andy for us?
Sure. So Andy Leonard is a big and longtime leader in the Richmond community. He's spent countless hours in supporting the user groups down in Richmond. He's helped them get organized, helped them get incorporated, helped kind of spread best practices around user group organization down in the Richmond area. He's also been a tireless leader for the Richmond Code Camps, I like to think of him as sort of the godfather of the Richmond user group community. So Andy is somebody I've been working with for quite a few years, and he's always far too kind and praising of those around him and not nearly praising enough of himself. So really glad to get Andy on the show.
Oh, well, thanks, Andrew.
You're welcome.
Lynn, thank you for that introduction. I'm not being kind. I tell it like it is. We have a fantastic team in Richmond for code camps and for the user group leadership, and we have a pretty neat model set up for the user groups. We have a corporation, not-for-profit corporation, and a four-person board that oversees all that, and it's been a real honor just to be part of that. I can't say enough about the community and how many hours other folks put into this and how much they work. And I don't know about that Godfather thing or not. Maybe that's Italian, isn't it? Maybe from Southern Italy. I don't know.
Yeah, and to be clear, my point isn't to run anybody else down. I think you do an awful lot of work in the community, and I definitely want to recognize that.
I appreciate you saying that, Andrew. Everybody does a – We have a ton of good folks, and you're one of those good folks. You've helped us out immensely, and really appreciate the work that you've done. And we refer to you affectionately in Richmond, and no offense, Glenn, as the best damn developer evangelist on the planet. So we love you, man.
As I say, you're too kind, but I'll take it.
All right, guys. So let's jump into it. We've got a lot of folks on the call that are waiting for us to talk about SQL Server integration services. And the community is a great way to learn about stuff, and I hope at the end maybe we'll talk about some things like SQL Server Identities. But just in general, if people are not familiar with SQL Server integration services, Andy, give us sort of the quick overview of why somebody would be interested in using these and what kinds of things they can expect to be able to.
Okay. Well, SSIS is Microsoft's enterprise data integration tool. And folks probably remember DTS, or Data Transformation Services, that was released when SQL Server 2000, I think it was actually before 2000. It may have been 7.0. I didn't get to use it until 2000. And a fantastic product. It had some shortcomings, but it was really neat to see something that gave you that visual design model in a database paradigm. So, what grew out of that? SSIS started as basically an outgrowth of DTS, but from the anecdotes I've heard from the development team, they ended up completely scrapping and rewriting the code from the ground up. To rebuild SSIS. So in the 2005 version, SSIS is a version 1.0 product. And that being said, it's very impressive. It's not without quirks and bugs, excuse me, but it is very impressive as a version 1.0 product. And it literally allows developers to visually design a data integration solution. And what I mean by that is its primary function is to move data from some source to some destination. And it's not limited to SQL Server. It can read data from flat files and write it into SQL Server. It can pull data from other database management systems like DB2 and Oracle and write those into SQL Server or flat files. It's very powerful, runs off of a provider model, and just allows you to do all sorts of data integration tricks. And part of the thing that I found fascinating about it is just the extensibility that the team built into it. It's not unusual for Microsoft, when they design platforms, to add snippets of extensibility where you can add a tweak here or update some XML file there and get some new functionality out of it. They allow us in SSIS to do everything in C++ or the managed languages, C# and VB.net, up to the point where we can literally construct a package, an SSIS package in RAM from .NET code, configure it, and execute it, and it never lives anywhere except inside of the computer's memory. That's pretty powerful.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, the accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a question
now,
from we got a question from one of our audience members looking for a good source for tips and tricks for common tasks with SSIS, like, for example, splitting an input stream into inserts, updates, and deletes. You have
that's a good tips and tricks
location?
Yeah, there's lots of good blog information out there for that sort of thing. And Microsoft, MSDN's website has that, as well as books online. I would recommend that that anybody interested in that take a glance at least at the slowly changing dimension wizard documentation. That may put you on the right path. But I've also written and spoken quite a bit about incremental loads at my blog, and I think you guys have a link to that coming up at the end. But I blog primarily now at sqlblog.com. So if you go out there and just click on my name or type in incremental loads, it talks about that. And, I've done several articles there, and also I've written some articles at SQLServerCentral.com on incremental loads as well. I can show you real quick, if I can share here, some quick ways of doing that. Is
sure.
Okay for me to
That'd
take
be great.
All right, I'm going to share my desktop here. And what I have here is a very basic package that I'm displaying now in SSIS. I'm going to create a new one right here on the fly. And by the way, they teach you when you do presentations to never do what I'm about to do here. This is bad. But if I go to the Dataflow Toolbox, you never create a demo on the fly. If I go to the Dataflow Toolbox here, I can open its toolbox and bring in an OADB source. And to get this to work, I need to connect it to a connection manager. And you can see the error is a connection manager hasn't been assigned. If I right-click that and edit it, I have no connection managers defined. They actually live in a window down at the bottom of the data. So if I click on the new button here, I can define a new one right here for us. And I'm going to pick AdventureWorks. I've already got that one configured. And I'm going to do, for data access mode, I'm going to go to a SQL command. So from this command, I'm just going to type a real quick statement. Contact ID, first name, middle name, last name, and person.contact. I think I've worn out the person.contact table. And I can click this preview button, and it'll tell me if I've written a good query, and I have. When I click OK, my error's gone. And if I want to load some destination, I can just pump this straight over using OADB destination. I can pump it straight into that, and again, it's not configured. I'm going to add another new destination, and I'm going to send this to my test database. And this time, it's giving me these data access modes. I can go and straight into a table of view using fastload. This is actually a bulk insert. I have a table of view that's not a fastload. This writes an insert statement for each row. And while that sounds cursor-ish, if that's a word, it's still pretty quick, but not nearly as quick as this table of view from fastload. Now, one of the other things I can do is I can build a new table in that destination database. And I'm going to call this GeekSpeak destination in honor of Glenn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you get for putting me on your show. As soon as I click the OK button, it's actually built that table over in my test DB. And I do this a lot when I'm developing SSIS packages. I rarely go into SSMS and do any work. I do it all from here. So when I click OK after assigning the mappings, it's basically built a loader. And this is just a straight insert. It'll run this and pump this data into there. But what I'd like to do is what the question really talked about is I'd rather come in and detect new rows. So if I only want to look up new rows, I can use a lookup transformation, a pretty cool way to do it, and I connect the OADB output to the lookup transformation's input. I want to look up what's in the destination, so I'm going to connect to that destination database. And I told you that table was there. There it is. There's GeekSpeak Destination.
Hmm.
When I click on columns, it maps all of these columns. Now, one way to look at a lookup is it's doing a select top one. That's the part to keep in mind when you're thinking about it in terms of T-SQL. This is a select top one. But it also behaves like a join. And by default, it acts like an inner join. And all of these mappings that you see here, these make up the on clause. So right now, it's doing a join on the rows rows that comprise the available input columns. These are the ones coming from the AdventureWorks person.contact table. And it's joining them to the rows that live in the destination database, TestDB, and the GeekSpeak destination table. And it's joining them on contact ID equals contact ID and first name equals first name and so forth. Well, I'm going to delete these because I really don't want all of those joins to be true. I really want to just join between the contact ID and the contact ID. And the reason is that's a business key. It's a unique identifier for that row in the source and the destination database. And I'm going to bring that guy back. And I'm going to flag it. I'm going to alias it here. This is like adding, in T-SQL, adding an as clause in the select statement. So I'm going to say select this destination contact ID as DEST underscore contact ID. Now, the other thing that I want to do is, the other particular thing about a lookup is not only is it a select top one, but if it fails to find a match in that on clause, this will fail. This transformation will blow up. In fact, I'll show you. I'm going to go ahead and complete this. I've got one more step I need to do in the middle. Just need to make sure that all of these mappings took. When I change things like using a lookup, sometimes they won't. And if I execute this task, we'll see that the lookup will fail because there's no data in the destination table for it to join to. By default, it's going to fail. Another thing you'll note is there's 19,970-some rows in the person.contact table. It only picked up 9,934 rows. By default, SSIS tries to load data a buffer at a time. And when I'm explaining this to people in training or speaking at seminars, I use this example. If you want to learn more about SSIS right now, you go type SSIS into Bing or your favorite search engine, and then you hit enter, and you wait for 45 minutes while all 18 million pages load into your browser, right?
Mm-hmm.
No. You wait less than a second while the first 10 pages, the links to the first 10 pages load, and that's called pagination in a web browser. It's a form of buffering, and that's exactly what's happening here. These 9,934 rows are being picked up one buffer at a time, and they're being acted on in RAM. And this is one of the things that makes SSIS data flow and the pipeline architecture just so darn fast. It screams.
Wow. Yeah.
It stays in RAM. And RAM is what? 1,000 times faster than, a spindle hard drive. So if you don't have to do I.O., then, that's the bottleneck in almost everything because it's so much slower than RAM. If you can stay in RAM, then you can make this thing just fly. It's equivalent to moving to an SSD hard drive where everything is just so much faster.
Wow.
So they really did a great job in this architecture. I can't say enough about the work that they did. But that failed, and the reason that it failed will show up here in my execution results tab. And that error, let me start this. I don't know if you can see that error really well, but if I zoom in, it says row yielded no match during lookup.
Yeah.
Exactly what we expect to happen because there is no data in the destination.
And where does this output go if you're running this not in an interactive environment, if it's running on as something that you start programmatically?
You mean the execution results?
Yeah.
That's a great question. It bubbles up into what's called an on-information event. And you can have event handlers. You can create an event handler for the package.
Okay.
That will automatically write that information to a custom log for you, or you can define logging here. You can set up a log and say, I want all of my information to go, my on information, written to a text file or a SQL Server table.
I see.
Analysis after the fact.
So I think this would be preferable than handling your own events.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And I mean, it kind of depends on what you're after. I talk some about SSIS frameworks, and I typically do manage my own events in there, but I'm doing it for another reason than just trying to capture the information. I'm also trying to capture it centralized. So that's a little bit for the end of the show. We can talk about that some more.
Sure.
I currently manage, Glenn, I manage 40 ETL developers. And have you ever tried to get 40 developers to do the same thing the same way? I love them. They're great people. But if I could find a way to externalize this logging, I can get it in the same format and in the same place, and they don't have to write a line of code.
Yeah.
That's what I do. And I use the event handler to do that, along with a parent-child pattern.
Hmm.
If we drop back into this data flow, I can make this behave. It's not behaving like an inner join right now, but it's comparable. I can make it behave more like an outer join. And what I did was I clicked the configure error output button. And this lookup, this is what failed. And it failed because it's configured by default if it cannot find a match to fail the component. So I'm going to tell it to ignore that failure. And what it's going to do now is load all those new rows from that table right over into the destination table. And you saw it buffering there if you watched it. It went one buffer, two buffers, and then the third buffer.
Yep.
As it loaded the information.
So now that we've made this succeed, let's take a step up a level or out a level, and can you talk about the scenario where this particular, like, what you're doing right here, when would you do that? What would the scenario be that would cause you to need to use SSIS in this way?
That's a great question. If I'm trying to move data from an OLTP database, let's say I'm running live.com on SQL Server, which I believe they are, and that's running 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
It's high availability, just a fantastically busy environment. What I don't want to be doing is querying those databases that are doing the business of running the website for reporting data. So what I really want to do is I want to stand up another database over here that I can execute my reports against that has near real-time data, as near real-time as I can get out of those production databases that are online.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I would build a loader like this to pull that data over to keep it synced as much as possible.
Do you do transformations at the same step, or do you just say, okay, let me get everything over as quickly as possible in its original format, and then I'll massage it into a different layout if I need it?
Well, you're trying to make me say that phrase that I don't want to say in SQL Server land, but I'll have to break down now and just use it. The answer is it depends. So it depends on a lot on size and shape of the data. It goes down, Glenn, to network topology, which design approach I'm going to take.
Oh, okay.
Right now I'm running in SQL Server 2005 because there are still quite a few customers out there on 2005. And while there are significant differences between 2005 and 2008, the same principles apply. For instance, lookup is way different in SSIS 2008 than this lookup in 2005. Vastly improved, in my opinion. But when you're talking about the architecture, yeah, staging data is something that I do. Most of the time, I'd say the biggest driver of that is if I'm pulling from a non-Microsoft source. That's usually a gimme that I'm going to go with staging the data. I'm going to pull over what I need just as fast as I possibly can, load it into a schema that has no keys, nothing to interfere with the insert statements or the bulk load operations, and I'm going to be able to run like that for several months before someone discovers it, that I've got a copy of production out there. Someone's using it, and they're going to start hitting it and using it for some other application. But we have ways of dealing with that, too. But, yes, definitely stage it. Staging it first is one method, and then after that stage, running a second package that does transformation. And this what you see here is very much like what you would see in a staging operation.
Gotcha. Well, Andy, we've got a ton of questions in the queue. Let's work through some of them based on what we've got up on the screen, what we were just talking about.
Okay.
Jeff wants to know, could you describe the pros and cons of storing packages in the various possible locations, file system, SQL Server, et cetera?
Yeah, I could do that, but I'm not going to, Jeff. I'm kidding. There's some good reasons for storing stuff in the SQL Server database, in MSDB. Things like being able to restore those packages for offsite security reasons, mm-hmm. just good DR disaster recovery schemes. That's a big driver for putting things in MSDB. I prefer working in the file system mainly because I execute the short version is it works well with the application lifecycle management philosophy that I employ. It's not that you cannot do application lifecycle management in SQL Server.
Yeah.
It just affects it. So I usually manage these as files. There's security implications whichever way you go. If you go with the storing things in SQL Server, you need to manage those roles effectively. And the same thing goes for the file system. There's really no advantage over doing that. And the biggest point is there's really no difference in the execution, because if you query the sysdts packages 90 table in MSDB and pull out the information that's in that text field, what you get is the XML that is stored in the file if you save it as a DTSX file. So there's really no difference. What you're storing is XML. It's read in by the execution engine, DTExec, or if you're using the job step type for SQL agent job, or if you're starting it from an application and written in .NET or C++. It all gets read in. The XML is read in. Then it's interpreted, and then after the interpretation, it executes. So it's really no performance reasons. It's more about your organization, what you're comfortable with, and that sort of thing, what your DR strategy is.
All right. So, Andy, I think this one will be right up your alley, given some of the crossover you do between kind of the DBA and developer roles. Eric wants to know, how do you guys recommend isolating roles between the DBA/ETL developer? He says, I sometimes think that Microsoft thinks that every SSIS ETL developer is also a DBA. So like saving packages back to MSDB requires access to write to MSDB, et cetera. And he notes that as a DBA, he doesn't want developers deploying packages to MSDB. So I'm going to leave it at that and let you kind of go with your answer.
Okay. I'll tell you what I do with my team at Unisys. I have the DBAs do the deployment. And that meant we had to train the DBAs a little bit in the intricacies of SSIS. We actually built a custom process to do the deployments for us. That was a lot of fun. I'm using the word fun sarcastically. I hear what you're saying. I don't think Microsoft did that intentionally. I don't think they were being mean, basically, when they separated those roles that way. But you're right. If you store it in MSDB or in the SSIS package store, which is an integration services service, then, yeah, you have to be aware of those roles and how that's impacted. And, again, since we do this in the file system, our deployments are a little bit different. We push that hassle off the DBAs, really, and onto the network admins. So they manage it from the file system. I don't know if that answers your question or not. Ask a follow-up if I didn't.
Well, Andy, we've got one kind of related to where you save the package, and this is what you save in it. And Steph wants to know, or says, I've seen a number of questions around don't save sensitive and package configurations. I guess that's things like connection strings.
Well, if you're right here on the package that I'm displaying, if I go back to the control flow, mm-hmm. excuse me, one of the settings for the package is the package protection level.
Right.
And it defaults to encrypt sensitive with user key, which isn't a great description of what's going on here. The don't save sensitive is another setting here. And a lot of people go with that. If you use this setting, that forces you to externalize your connections metadata. And there's some benefits to that. It's going to depend on the types of connections you're hitting and the types of destinations you're writing to. But it does force you to deal with security up front, especially if you're externalizing connection metadata.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one way to approach it. One way to troubleshoot security issues, and I've written about this quite a bit in the forums, is to use any of these encrypt sensitive with password or encrypt all with password settings here. This encrypts the entire package, and you can save passwords to connection strings inside of the connection manager's configuration.
Oh, okay.
What I'm talking about is this connection string here.
Sure.
Sorry, that jumps around on me some. So if I had a connection string that had a password, and I don't, I'm using Windows authentication here, but if I had a user ID and password in this string, then this would allow me to save that, and it would actually store it with the package since the package is now encrypted. And if it's encrypted in any of these ways, if it's encrypted with encrypt all with password or encrypt sensitive with password, and sensitive would include passwords on connection strings.
Oh, I see.
Then what you've done is you've kind of scoped all of your connection permissions management into this package as far as SSIS is concerned. So I recommend that people do that when they're troubleshooting. The common problem is I built this on my laptop or on my workstation and it runs fine, and then when I deployed it to the server, it fails and it gives me some error like something with cannot acquire connection in it, which you know would make me automatically jump to the protection level property on the package, right? If you saw that error, I'm kidding. Sorry there, SSIS team. Take that knife out of your back. But this is a way to troubleshoot if it's truly a permissions issue or not.
Right. How do you send the password in when you are running the package on the server?
Well, there's a couple of ways. If I encrypt all encrypt sensitive with password here, actually it won't take because I don't have anything sensitive in this package. But if I encrypt all with password, I can hit this ellipse and use my favorite password, 12345.
Sure.
Because, you know, spaceballs. When I go to execute the package, there's a lot of ways to do it. One way is to run it right here in vids. I can just start debugging. Another way is let's open a command prompt here real quick. And I can type the dtexec command.
Oh, okay.
And I can execute it right here from the command line. Now, it comes back and tells me you need to supply some more information. You need to give me a path to the file. And if I did that, one of the parameters that I would use would be the decrypt. And it doesn't have to be all caps. I usually do that. And then I could pass in 12345.
I see.
And it would take off with that.
Okay.
All right. So, Andy, one of the tests that you did during this process is you did a lookup task, I think.
Yep.
And Remdots wants to know if there are any tips you have around performance. Are there any performance issues to look out for when you're doing lookup tasks?
Oh, another great question. Gosh, you guys are good. Yes, lots of performance issues that you can have with the lookup. One of the big ones is if right now I'm doing a lookup against a table with four columns.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not really bringing that much information into RAM. And keep in mind, SSIS is going to try to stay in RAM. But I did a job once where I was doing I was loading an SAP destination, and the table had something like 175 columns in it or something like that.
Wow.
Well, when I did a lookup with that, the last thing I want to do is go here to the reference table and pick this table or view.
Mm-hmm.
What I really want to do is something that I can demonstrate here, where I could say select contact ID
right
from GeekSpeak destination.
And you got to limit that, you got to limit what you're pulling back, just like you would no select star, right?
Exactly, and it's very. If you look at if you use SQL Server Profiler and watch what this is doing when you're executing the package, you can see it doing things like select star in these lookups. And that's why I'm very picky about using those in a lookup, and also using SQL commands in the sources, because it'll do that. It'll run select star in a heartbeat. And you don't get a huge performance boost out of that, but when you multiply the performance that you get out of SSIS in the lookup from pulling back just a field or three or four fields that you need versus 170, it starts to add up pretty quickly. I mean, you know, it's a couple gig here and a couple gig there, and pretty soon you're talking about serious performance changes.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you can also do some tweaking on the advanced tab. You can enable memory restriction. And one thing SSIS, one characteristic of SSIS is that it is a memory hog. It'll eat up your RAM. But it's that's by design, right? It's trying to stay off your I/O. So we want it to eat up RAM, but we can enable caching and say, hey, don't do anything beyond 5 megabits when you're running in 32-bit mode, or also 5 meg. You may want to bump that, maybe 25 meg if you're running in 64-bit mode.
Okay.
You know, choke this thing down just a little bit. Don't go hog wild on your lookup. You can also change the way the lookup works. By default, the lookup does what we call, it says partial caching, but I believe by default, that changed because I made those changes on the advanced tab. By default, it does full caching. And that means it's going to execute whatever's in that select statement, whether it's select star or select contact ID. It's going to execute that first. In fact, we should be able to see it where it pulls in a cache of rows. And you can see here that it did a cache. Now, it only looked up zero rows there, but it could look up, you know, just as easily 4 billion rows.
Right.
And that's what it'll do if you're running in full cache mode, is it'll do this lookup ahead of time. So you can make a couple of decisions about how you want to do caching. One of them is, you know, by default is full. You can go to partial, and what partial gives you is when a row comes through, it will execute the select statement against the database, and it'll bring those first lookup fields back. The second time a row comes through, if the data is different, it'll execute the select again. But if the data is the same, if the on clause part is the same and the values match, it'll read from a cache. So it's building this cache as it goes. Now, partial won't help you if all of the rows flowing through here are unique. If you're doing that, you're basically running a none, which is every row that comes through, I want you to execute that select statement. And there are some use cases where this is the fastest performance you're going to get out of this guy.
Right.
The biggest one that leaps to mind is if you're in a RAM-restricted environment. So if you're not, the boxes that I work on at Unisys have 96 CPUs and a terabyte of RAM.
Mm-hmm.
You probably don't
Woo!
Have those at your house.
How do I get one of those?
Oh, talk to me after the show. it's phenomenal. I'm like a kid in a candy store. You know, I go nuts when I'm running SSIS out there because you can massively parallel process and you know, SSIS being a RAM hog, I mean, a terabyte of RAM, can you imagine? So it's the machines that Microsoft has used to set the records for loading a terabyte of data. They've used the ES7000s to set some of those early records. I'm not sure which box they've used lately, but
mm-hmm.
the last number I heard was they loaded a terabyte of data in 10 minutes. And my friend Hank Vandervalk over in the Netherlands, he helps with that, helps those tests and figuring out how to make SSIS scream.
Wild.
I think I beat that question to death.
That was a good answer.
So we've got one from Sergio. He's looking for some tips on how to consume SSIS, or I guess maybe get the packages to run from a web client such as ASP.NET or a desktop client.
Oh, you can't do that, Sergio. Just give up.
Huh.
I'm kidding. There is a
You're going to make everybody leave because you first tell them you can't do it.
I'm sorry.
That's the expert, though.
I'm a very corny person. I'm sorry about that. Sergio, there's a really
good example
of that. In the SQL Server 2005 Integration Services book, the Professional Rocks book, I haven't read all of the newer books that have come out, but I helped work on that book, and I actually did the tech edit on that chapter. And you can execute an SSIS package directly from ASP.NET.
Mm.
And a guy named Mike Murphy wrote that chapter, and like I said, I did the tech edit on it. The reason he asked me to do it is he knows how little C# I know, and he figured if I could do it, then anyone could. I would point you to that. And if you, you know, I don't know if Mike blogs. He wasn't blogging recently, so I don't know. I don't know a good blog site to point you to, but it's definitely in that book. And I can't remember the chapter number. I want to say it's around 15 or 16, Mike's chapter on that.
Okay. And how about the desktop client?
Oh, from the desktop, well, there's a couple of ways you can schedule, and I showed you the one way. You can execute it from, if you call this command line, that's one way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a decent way to do it. If you find yourself poking around in SSIS, and I'm just going to open up a package here. Just going to pull one out of my a presentation I did for this past summit late last year. And if you open it up here, it'll open in this way. And if I right click on this, I may have messed up my box. But there is a execute package utility. If you on your machine, if you double click it, it will open like this. So I don't know if you can see this or not, but it's the execute package utility, and it's already set up as a file system package. Notice you can execute stuff in SQL Server or in the SSIS package store, and the box is already filled in. This is the incremental load.dtsx package.
Mm-hmm.
And you have all of these settings that you can set over here. What I like about it is when you're done is it builds this command line for you, and I just clicked on there, so it's building it. And the only thing missing from this command line is that DT exec statement. So if I copy this and run back into here and do a real quick paste in my command window, that'll actually run. It should. Let me see. Yeah, it's running now.
Huh.
So it executed. It failed, but it executed. I can also execute it from here, and it will also fail. And what it brings up is something that looks very much like the execution results or the progress that we were seeing before.
Yeah.
This log information. And what I get questions on a lot of time is, when people ask me, can you save this information? And I think Glenn, you asked that question earlier.
Right.
They really want these icons, and I don't know a way to get these icons. I've tried to bribe the team at Microsoft. Can you work this into the next version so I can just write this out somewhere and it'll build me a web page or something that looks like this?
Mm-hmm.
So far, I haven't been able to find it, but that's two ways to execute it. Again, you can hit the application namespace, the SSIS application namespace, and it'll also do that for you.
Cool. We have two out here that are, I think, related. They have to do with the whole more of the development process itself. And I'll ask them both, and we can maybe talk about them together in context. But Aaron wants to know if there's a way that he can identify changes, like doing a code diff between versions of an SSIS package saved in source code management. And Jeff wants to know if there's any sort of automated build and unit testing with SSIS. They're trying to find a workable process that they can use with Team Foundation Server.
Yeah, that's a couple of really good questions.
Yeah.
The one of the reasons that code diff is difficult is I'll go back here and open this package up so you can see it in Notepad. Part of what's in here, and I can't show you all of this. I'm just doing a pretty bad job of showing you this. But part of what's in here is the location. This is I compare this, although it's not a good analogy. I compare this to old ASP. And back in those days, you had positional data in with your logic.
Right.
And that was, I mean, you could do code behind, but it wasn't easy. And, you know, when the ASP.NET model came along, it pretty much started out as a standard with code behind. You could, in order to change that, you'd have to change the way that the page was written to start with. The defaults were different. So you can see things here like this left and this top. So if I go in and open this package up and I move this one pixel to the left, and I end up with 09 here, that's a different line at that point. And it's a little tough to do the code diff because of that.
I see. Yeah, because you don't need to be concerned with the layout and the designer surface as much as what the steps are throughout the package, and I guess it's hard to abstract that away that you can be able to analyze it.
It is. Now, I've seen some really good attempts. I haven't dug into any of to anything yet that makes the claim that it can do a SSIS code diff. I've been approached about it, and my response was good luck with that. You know, I could it be done? Yeah. I don't know that it would be worth the effort. You know, it's kind of like I'm kind of holding out and hoping that they'll do something similar to the ASP.NET model, where they separate the positional data and the visual and graphics layer from the actual code that matters. Because the stuff that I care about is really things that are down in here some, like these properties. You know, I want to know the differences in these properties and in the SQL statements and in the script task scripting and that sort of stuff. I really don't care about, you know, where things are positionally on it. If you want to invert the position, I really don't care about that. I just want to know that this stuff right here where I'm doing this select statement, that's the sort of stuff that I'm worried about. So, and the other one was about application lifecycle management and doing automated testing. There are some products out there. I say products. There's a CodePlex project that does some unit testing, supports some unit testing. And my friend John Welch, I believe, was had a hand in that. I don't know if he was the guy who championed that or not. But John's one of those scary smart people.
Mm-hmm.
And he's worked with that. I've done some tinkering with it as well in custom build tasks in the beta versions of TFS 2008. And I even presented on it at the PaaS Summit back in 2007. I had some success with it where it was mostly along the lines of integration testing, really, a functional testing. It wasn't unit testing per se.
Mm-hmm.
But TFS is extensible. And you can do custom build tasks, and you can deploy an SSIS package to a target. But I can't speak to the full version, the RTM version of TFS 2008. But I built a custom task that would actually do it, that would do the copy for me.
Wow!
I'm doing a copy in a file. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
Don't be impressed. Just.
Well, I'm just thinking about the big picture of all the stuff you have to do to set up the databases that you're reading from and writing to a known state, and then, you know, run the package and then test the result to see if you got the right, you know, actions to happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of complexity involved in doing something like that, and that's one of the reasons that this kind of goes back to the argument about, you know, the problems with ORMs that you hear about, the object relational mappers, is there is a definite impedance mismatch between databases and applications. And SSIS, frankly, straddles it. I mean, it's right there with ORMs. It's part application and it's part database. And, you know, as a result of that, the complexity is just inherent. You can't escape it. You have to fight it when you work with SSIS. And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons why people realize the power of SSIS, but then they start working with it and they become frustrated because it's so difficult to learn. And it really is. I can hear them. I mean, if I look at some of this stuff, I'm just going to pop open an editor here real quick, an expressions editor, just to pick a property. Like I can externalize this connection string, and I can do it using the expression language here. I can build, you know, dynamically build an expression here that, you know, may say, you know, data source equals, data source equals, and then I can concatenate onto it some data source variable. Now, I don't have a data source variable, so this will bomb. It'll tell me you can't find it.
Right.
But I can do this and dynamically build this with expression language, but expression language is kind of hard to learn. You got to know, you know, you got to learn it, and then you got to learn how to use it and where you can use it in SSIS, and it's pretty formidable. I also run into folks who never use data flows in SSIS. Being a manager, I interview people, and I regularly ask them questions about their experiences, and a lot of times folks are using SSIS as the control flow, really as a workflow surface, and they're just doing a bunch of execute SQL tasks. And if I open this up, I can, you know, configure it to a database, and then I can write a SQL statement here that does the exact same thing all the work in my my data flow is doing.
Yeah.
And it'll work up until a certain point. If I'm loading 10,000 or 100,000 rows, it may not be a big difference. In fact, it may be faster this way, depending on all of the factors that impact performance. But if I start loading 4 or 5 billion rows and I've got, you know, I'm using 2 or 3 servers, I've got an SSIS application server in the middle of two servers, then it gets real hairy and SSIS will just outperform any SQL attempt.
Yeah, and I think the real value in finding somebody who has experience with this is having them know the difference, be able to say, well, okay, I'm hitting the wall here. There's certain conditions or certain criteria that it's going to say, look, let me move away from just regular SQL statements and go to a data flow task.
Yep.
What about one of the ones that jumps to my mind is the ability to monitor the output. And if you run a query that moves data from one place to another, it's running in a box and you can't really tell what's going on.
That's correct.
When you have your data flow, it's like, well, this is a business activity or something like that, and I can monitor it, I can have it report errors, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, in fact, there's a nice little built-in facility here called Data Viewers in the Designer. And I can pick different types of ways to look. Like I can look at a grid, which is common, but I can also generate a histogram or scatter plot or a column chart. You know, I want this little data viewer thing in reporting services. This is kind of handy. And in my grid, I can even configure which columns I want to see. Maybe I don't want to see middle name. I can drag it out. And when I click OK and execute this again, what it does is it serves not only as a way to view the data, but it also serves as a breakpoint. So now it's showing me my contact ID and my first name and my last name. Now, down here it's telling me that it sent 9,934 rows in, and this is the first buffer that it's displayed, that it's run, and the rows displayed is 9,934. If I hit this play button one more time, it loads the second buffer, and I think it loads the second buffer. I love it when computers do what you want them to. I need the Do What I Mean button. But it'll actually stop and pause on each one of these guys. I don't know why it's not doing that. Sorry. But it's not.
Is it because they're already in the table?
I might have too much going on there. Well, it should have tried to process that, but
okay.
It's actually doing the lookup. You're absolutely right. It was doing that lookup, and it was doing, I think I left it set on none for the cache mode. So it ran through all of those, and it did the lookup for those guys.
Okay.
And then if I hit it again, we'll have to wait a similar amount of time before it displays the rest of the rows. But down here, it gives me a total count of the rows that have come through. And again, that's 9,934 times 2. And it pre-sized those buffers. It does a really quick profile of the data in the source and determines how many rows it wants to put in a buffer. The default is 10,000 rows or 10 meg, whichever is less. And you can configure those, both of those numbers. And again, that's part of tweaking a data flow to make it scream.
Very cool.
All right, so we're close to about 5 minutes to go. We've got a few more questions in the queue. One that you could probably knock out pretty quickly is a question of 32-bit versus 64-bit, if there are any tips or things to be aware of when you're moving to 64-bit.
Yep. The script engines are different because you're hitting the .NET framework. And the .NET framework is different for 64-bit than it is for 32-bit. So you're going to run into some stuff there. 99% of the time, you can clear it by just going to the script component or the script task and opening up the script editor and then closing it. I don't know why that works, but it does. The other thing is, if you're doing loads from things like Excel, there is no 64-bit native Excel driver. There are ways to do – there's two approaches to it. There's a way to get Excel data, to read Excel data, especially in 2007, using the there's an XML provider, and you can use an OADB connection manager to read that XML. The other approach is you can basically tell the SSIS package run as a 32-bit package. And let me show you that really quick. If I can get this to stop, I can show you on the control flow. If you go into a project and look at the properties, while you're running in debug, here's the run 64-bit runtime. It's set to true because this is a 64-bit laptop. But if I change it to false, I can now read native Excel.
That kind of ties in with a comment from Jeff. He says, if you're working with Oracle, your life is easier with 32-bit SSIS.
That's a great comment. Yeah, absolutely right.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff.
All right,
any other gotcha support for that?
I agree. Anything else for that? Any other questions?
So I think see if you can get through quickly. There are a couple of questions, both Roundus and Bill have questions around, Roundus and Cameron have questions around configuration files. Cameron asks, can you talk about creating and using configuration files in a package? And Roundus asks, when using configurations for SSIS, which is preferred, XML or SQL Server-based configurations?
Great questions again. I just right-clicked in the white space of the control flow, mm-hmm. and the package configurations organizer popped up. When I click the Add button, there's a window that comes up first, a welcome screen. You can skip that, and I do. And then you have all of these ways that you can store information. In addition to the XML configuration, you can also set up an indirect XML configuration where you store the path to the DTS config file, which is the XML config file. You store that in an environment variable. And that's pretty handy because let's say you get 40 packages on a drive, somewhere, and you're using this environment variable. If the file has to move for some reason, maybe the SAN administrator whacks your S drive or your Z drive, and now you have to move it to a D or a W drive or something like that. Well, if you've used this environment variable, you just have to go in and make the change in one place, and all 40 of your packages just continue to run.
Oh, that's cool.
Whereas if you've hard-coded it, you have to go to 40 places and change it.
Wow.
I use both. I use the config files and the SQL Server configurations. I find the SQL Server configurations are handy because I can connect to them with reporting services. And I just don't do a lot with XML and reporting services. It's probably possible to hit an XML source. I just don't know how to do it. But I definitely know how to do it with SQL Server sources. So I can see my configuration data in an SSIRS application. That's one advantage of it.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, we are just like 2 minutes away from the end, so we want to go back to one of the slides that has our resources page on it. So just point you, everybody who is listening in and watching, we've got our blog at blogs.msdn.com/geekspeak, and you can look there for a post that we'll put up in a couple of days containing a lot of the reference material that Andy mentioned here related to SSIS, including the ROCS books and some of the other blog posts. You can also see some of our upcoming GeekSpeak webcasts. We have them every other Wednesday, and we've got a lot of cool topics on tap for April. And you can also catch recordings of our past shows on Channel 9. That link is here as well. My blog is here, as well as Andrew's blog. And Andy, I think I've got your blog right. It's on sqlblog.com, correct?
Yep, that's it.
Okay. So, folks, feel free to hit us up for resources related to the topic that we covered today. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up by thanking Andy for coming on and sharing us with us all this cool SSIS insider information.
Well, thank you guys for having me, man. This was awesome.
Cool. And, Andrew, thanks for co-hosting.
Absolutely. Always great to get one of my Richmond peeps on board, and I think great show by Andy, and hope everybody enjoyed it.
Definitely. And we've got a survey coming up, and we hope folks will stick around just for a minute to fill that out. But at this point, I'll turn it over to our webcast producer to wrap it up.